It is a center for higher learning.
It is a place with centuries of secrets in its shadowed halls.
This is where you have come to learn the mysteries of the cosmos.
Welcome to the Miskatonic University Podcast.
They'll teach you things you can't unlearn.
Hello and welcome to the Miskatonic University Podcast, episode 152. This is the podcast dedicated to Call of Cthulhu and other horror and Lovecraft-related role-playing games. I'm Keeper Dan.
I'm Keeper Chad, and I don't know, I'm just really hoping that tonight's episode will resonate with some people.
And I'm Keeper John. Oh, don't worry about that, Chad. It should be beyond amazing.
Oh, so dear. We're talking about Tillinghast tonight. First, let's start with the campus crier.
Miskatonic University Campus Crier.
The Campus Crier's Miskatonic U student paper. Here's where we go through Mythos-related news and feedback for the podcast. This episode is being recorded on July 19th, 2018.
The Delta Green The Labyrinth Kickstarter is underway at the time of this recording and probably is about to close or be over by the time you're listening to this episode. Delta Green The Labyrinth is written by John Tynes and presents a source book for threats, allies, and mysteries to deepen the terrors of your Delta Green campaign. Links will be included in the show notes, but like I said, at the time of this recording, there's 11 days left to the campaign. They are already funded, so it is going to happen.
Yeah, 11 days means there's like 2 days or maybe 1 day left in the campaign when you hear this.
Yes.
So, totally. Here's something else I'm pretty excited about. Over the Edge, Return to the Island of Al-Amarja is in a new edition by Jonathan Tweet. This is a freeform role-playing game of paranormal chaos. It is... You know, Scott Dorward told me about it, and I remember saying that I wished somebody would make a William S. Burroughs role-playing game, which is a scary idea, but he said the closest thing he'd ever seen was Over the Edge, and this came out, I think, 1998, and it is quite awesome. It's hallucinogenic and weird, and it sort of follows the Burroughs North Africa flavor, so you're talking about weird druggy hallucinations and strange incomprehensible narratives and very surreal and somewhat random. And I have a copy of the old one because as he said that I searched and got the old version, but I'm pretty excited that there's a new one coming out. There is 25 days left to go, so you'll have, you know, a week or so or more to jump on this Kickstarter. It is now at $80,000 of a $50,000 goal. Has a lot of fans. 1,200 people are backing it at this point, so clearly
very
doing
cool.
Well.
I feel like I'm getting my freak on already.
Yeah. I want to see that, man.
Tales of Valor for Cthulhu has funded. All right. It
Yay!
Surpassed the $12,500 goal with 228 backers. And at the time of this recording, there are 9 days left to go. So by the time you're hearing this, it is probably already closed. Also, Sentinel Hill Press did a Q&A with Oscar about the project, mostly focusing on the Kingsport Council, Feline of Investigator Group, and the Gray in the Dark, a scenario set in Kingsport. And you can check that out in the show notes. We'll have links to both the Kickstarter and the Sentinel Hill Press interview.
And there's another Kickstarter here for a board game that by the time this episode drops, it'll actually be done. Because I'm looking at it now and it has 4 days to go. But I just put it into our media feed, so it will have been on our Twitter and Facebook and all that stuff. So anybody interested should hopefully jump in on that. I know I've released it previously as well. But this thing is a cooperative board game, which is pretty much my favorite type, and has amazing miniatures with it. Just scroll through this thing and look at the sculptures.
Yeah.
And then when you get down to the Rillia Raising expansion, and it is a massive Cthulhu statue, that the base of the statue is the new game board for that level.
Yep. Pretty so awesome.
Yeah.
I mean, this is an Eric Lang designed game from Cool Mini or Not, or CMON as they're now known. And it's, you know, as CMON is known for doing highly detailed miniatures, sculptured miniatures of monsters and the heroes, and just this game, it looks like, is not going to disappoint. So if you're a fan of Blood Rage, if you're a fan of Rising Sun, both of which are, you know, fantastic Eric Lang games, I think you're going to be pretty impressed with this Cthulhu game from him.
Yeah. I wish they had a smaller level where you could just pledge for a couple of the minis.
Right.
Mm.
I would be happy to pledge for just that Shoggoth and maybe a couple of others, because I really love the sculpting on these. But, you know, $100 for the base game and $250 to get the base game and the Rillia Rising.
Yeah. Which, if you think about it, for the size of that, it's not a miniature, it's a sculpture. And that sculpture, as well as all the game components and everything, $250 is a freaking steal.
Yeah. Yeah, I'm not objecting to their cost. I just can't afford it.
Oh, I hear you. So, it's beautiful.
The monster minis are just giving me the click finger. The little...
Yeah. Exactly.
That Chthonian that is so... H.R. Geiger.
Yeah, it feels like they did a little bit of reimagination with some of the creatures, but I love it. I love the direction they went.
Yeah.
The deep one looks
fire
amazing.
Fire vampires.
And
fire vampire looks like kind of a salamander, like a traditional Asian salamander.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yep.
Haster looks amazing.
Yep. Beautiful art.
Yeah.
And even something like the ghoul, to me, that is exactly how I picture a ghoul in my mind. It is just perfect.
I think their ghoul really nails how I always pictured them too.
Yep.
With the canine description.
It's spot on. Check out the Kickstarter through our media feeds, as it has already ended by the time you're listening to this episode. And if you are one of the few who have backed it and you live in Kansas City, look me up. I want to play. So, moving on. Guys, I was a guest on another podcast.
You harlot.
I was a guest.
You pod-shamed him. That's terrible.
I was a guest on Spellburn. For those who are not aware, Spellburn is a podcast that focuses on the Dungeon Crawl Classics role-playing game. And I believe it will be the very next episode that they publish, which would be episode 70. And it will be focusing on the use of the Cthulhu Mythos in a Dungeon Crawl Classics fantasy game.
Nice.
It was really fun. It was a lot of fun. They invited me on, and I talked about the different Cthulhu-inspired scenarios that I've written for Goodman Games. And some of the other like support materials. And then there's a new book coming out soon called The Cthulhu Alphabet. And Goodman Games, this will be their third alphabet book. They've done the Dungeon Alphabet, Monster Alphabet, which if you're not familiar with those books, it's a generic book of tables. So it's RPG system agnostic, so it can be for any game, and you can just get these tables, and like for maybe the monster book, one of the ones might be for ooze lords, and so you could look up ooze lords in O, and through the different tables you can randomly generate and create some sort of plasmatic ooze monster for your adventurers to encounter. And so the new one coming out, the Cthulhu alphabet is chock full from A to Z with different fun tables to spice up your game. That includes a Cthulhu Mythos element to it. So I was one of the writers on that book, and as well as several other folks. And of course, as with anything, I forget who I worked with. So there were just so many names. So I feel best not to miss anybody. So I'm not going to name anybody. But that was a lot of fun. So if you want to listen to that episode of Spellburn, we'll have a link in the show notes.
Sounds good. I will be doing that because I'm a spy. Amazon Studios has greenlit Tales from the Loop as an hour-long science fiction series. It is going to be executive produced by War for Planet of the Apes director Matt Reeves. The series is based on the famous artwork of Simon, and I think it's Stalenhag. I don't know what the Angstrom does above the ape.
I don't know.
You know, we know people who could have told us. We could have called. We could have called Magnus. I'm sure that he might correct us. Anyway, so it's a co-production with Fox 21 Television. It will be an 8-episode series helmed by Nathaniel Halpern. So, yeah. Anyway, we know it more as the role-playing game, right? It started as artwork. That artwork inspired a role-playing game, which has done really well, Emmy nominated.
Yeah.
And gorgeous. Now the loop involves a machine built to unlock and explore the mysteries of the universe, making things possible that were previously relegated to only science fiction. And yeah, it's pretty exciting because the loop itself, I've heard, is really great as a role-playing game. And maybe some people would be inspired after seeing the series to understand the genre. And want to play the role-playing game more.
And, Tales from the Loop is kind of in one of those kids on bikes, 1980s kids on bikes kind of thing. So this could be really cool, and it could be a strong competitor show for something like Stranger Things. So this will be pretty interesting. Mm-hmm. Looking forward to it.
Yeah, that's probably what they were thinking whenever they bought the rights to this.
Yeah, I'm sure.
It must have been in the elevator pitch.
Yeah.
Yep. You know that thing that sold really well and surprised everyone? We want to do this other thing.
Yeah.
That's like it.
Yeah. All right. And next up, there has now been an official release date for the official Call of Cthulhu computer game. Cool. It's going to be released on October 30th, 2018, this year! And so, that's going to be for computer and all the major consoles, and I'm looking forward to it. I don't do very many video games, but this is the official Call of Cthulhu video game. I'm getting this.
I feel like we've been talking about it for years.
We have.
Yeah, okay. I mean, I understand video games take years to make.
Yep.
That's reasonable.
True enough.
And also, speaking of projects we've been talking about for years, Punktown is finally out in PDF. That's the Miskatonic River Press production, their last, before they went the way of the winds.
Yeah.
And it's originally dropped in 2012, guys.
Yeah. That's when that project started up. Long time coming, but they did it.
The print version is still in progress, but you can get the PDF now. It is $15, and it's almost like a unicorn now. I feel like people should check it out just because it's in the wild.
Yeah. You know, we can only hope that it'll wind up being that awesome thing, kind of like Pulp Cthulhu, where it was, so long in the waiting, and it turned out to actually be worth the wait. So, we'll see. Yeah. But I haven't gotten it yet. I plan to shortly and start to flip through it and just kind of enjoy the setting because it's weird and kind of a cyberpunky Shadowrun meets Cthulhu thing. So I'm good for that.
I'm very curious. The cover art is the only thing I've ever really, committed to memory. And
Yeah. It looked very evocative of the 80s cyberpunk game.
Yeah, that looked really cool. And I just browsed the Chaosium blog and pulled another news article I thought was kind of interesting. I saw a mob talking about on social media, Cthulhu Chronicles. This is an app. Meta Arcade has launched the next chapter in the investigations in Lovecraft County series of linked adventures for the Cthulhu Chronicles. This is an original scenario called The Good Professor, and it builds on everything you have experienced so far in the Cthulhu Chronicles. And currently, right now, this is only available in the Apple App Store. So, and I know that they're working on eventually launching a Android device version, but these look super, super cool. There's a whole series of these adventures that you can play, and I'm imagining that they're you know, basically electronic versions of choose your own adventure, you know, solo play. But I can't wait. I'm on a Android device, so I can't wait for Cthulhu Chronicles to come to the Android app store, and so I can pick this up because I want to start playing these.
Yeah. That whenever that came out, and we're just like, oh, cool. You know, maybe one of us can get this and talk about it on the show. And turns out everybody on the podcast here uses Android, so not a one of us could actually look at this game. Yep. So, whenever they eventually release it for the other main platform, then we'll be able to take a look at it and see what all's going on with there. It's cool to see more stuff.
Yeah, it's cool that they're linked. So it's already a campaign. You know, it's a solo play campaign. So I'm assuming you have to play them in order. I know I saw in some screenshots that they're actually numbered, which at first I thought it was just they were numbered in the order that they were published. But now it makes me wonder. I bet that's the campaign order. So
yeah,
very cool.
Yes.
Cool. And one final note, a big thank you once again goes out to Max this time. Thank you so much, Max, for doing the editing on this show. And I should mention now that actually for weeks, he has been requesting that all of the hosts tape a sticky note to our computers, monitors that say, stop saying
what?
No, my pain.
I know.
There's also been there too. The lip smacks.
Yep, that's me. Yep. This is how I like to, when I'm really thinking of something, I'll start a sentence by saying, I don't know, guys.
Right.
We love you, Max.
Thank you, Max.
Thank you.
Yes, thank you very much.
Welcome to the listening room. Rewind your reels and enjoy your selections in silence.
Shh. And now we're going to go into the listening room. And this one's going to be a little different. In this episode, Mr. Tyler is turning his chair backwards and getting a little bit more serious about a personal matter that he wanted to bring up on the show. And so let's go ahead and listen to the good news.
Good morning, brothers and sisters. I'm taking a break from our usual detentions to just get a little bit more personal with you today and talk about some of the ways my faith interacts with my love of the atheistic horror of H.P. Lovecraft. The reason we are finding new things in these stories after 100 years of adaptation, proliferation, and too many plushies is because it has something to say about every single aspect of the human condition. Every faith and worldview interacts with the Cthulhu mythos in some form. Or rather, the mythology of the Cthulhu mythos has something to say about the validity of every faith and worldview. It's evergreen in that way. Now, I'm an evangelical Christian, fourth generation Wesleyan, thank you very much. I've been going to the same church for 25 years now. I've taught Sunday school for 10 of those years. And I'm a massive fan of the Cthulhu mythos. Now, I believe in a loving God. That's a fairly central tenet of Christianity. The Apostles' Creed, which is one of the earliest codifications of the core Christian beliefs, begins with, "I believe in God, the Father Almighty, creator of heaven and earth." That's a picture of a loving God, a God who provides, a God who loves us enough to send his son to die for our sins, which is very much at odds with the chaotic and uncaring higher beings which drift through the Lovecraftian universe with no more purpose than humanity. I think that makes cosmic horror more interesting and certainly more intriguing to me. When I read an H.P. Lovecraft story, my faith is not shaken, and I certainly still go to church every Sunday, thankful to have a God that I can trust. However, I think that all of us can agree that as a fiction reader, none of us are stepping into these stories thinking to ourselves, "Well, this is fake, I'm not interested." I think all of us sign the contract that while we're reading the story, we're going to suspend our disbelief and we're going to exist in the world of these stories. What's fun for me, though, is as a Christian, after enjoying that darkness and that gloom, I can sort of have my cake and eat it too by being chilled and horrified by the stories, and I get to have my faith strengthened by considering how glad I am that I don't exist in the Lovecraftian universe displayed here, and are able to bask once again in my belief in Christ Jesus, my Savior. There is one aspect of Lovecraftiana that falls strangely in line with my faith. Everybody goes in a Call of Cthulhu role-playing game with their eyes open about the overarching truth, about the pointlessness of the universe and the bleakness, but we're still, in almost every single scenario, fighting to save something. Whether it's a world or a single person, it's usually a sense of altruism, of trying to make the world better despite that evil. The sort of selflessness that Christians are called to have in Scripture, despite the chaos, despite the pointlessness. While some games highlight the futility quite well, for example, Delta Green, the theme of self-sacrifice permeates pretty much all Cthulhu role-playing games. The characters lose in the hope of a win for humanity, and that self-sacrifice is continually thrown in the face of the whole point of cosmic horror in a lot of ways. In the light of the Cthulhu mythos's nihilistic reality, the motivations and actions of the investigators are just as misguided and pointless as those of the most deranged and dangerous cultists. But their sacrifice still shines through, giving worth to the fundamentally worthless. Now, I know we're just talking about a game here, but my faith is important to me. It's the lens through which I view my entire life, including the atheistic horror of the Cthulhu mythos.
Thank you very much, Mr. Tyler.
That was awesome. Very well said.
Yeah. Wow.
Yeah.
And I think I'd like to share. I hope it's okay to share that he was unsure whether this would fit the show, and we kind of went back and forth a little bit about the concept, and you know, I definitely think that there's plenty of room to discuss what the game does for you personally, and you know what the Cthulhu mythos does and why Lovecraft talks to you, and so I thought that was great.
I think it's great. I mean, you know, as a player, he is able to approach the game differently or with a different perspective than I do, because I myself am an atheist, so it's, you know, I don't have some of those sensibilities that will come, I think, probably more naturally for him as a player, and so he can infuse that into his characters and even role play what those effects would have on a character of faith when your sanity is being shattered, you know, and I think that brings an extra layer of gameplay to the table, and I think that's really cool, you know. And on the flip side, if in real life, if I was suddenly confronted with the reality that there are these creatures, you know, that maybe they're aliens, maybe they're gods, and they have, maybe it's science, maybe it's magic, you know, that can warp reality and do horrific things, I would probably become a pretty quick Christian. You know, I would suddenly go, if there's this much bad, magical bad, there's got to be magical good, and I want to find it, and I want to learn about it, you know? Mm-hmm. So
That's interesting.
You know, huh. I think that's, yeah, you know, I'm, that's... but anyways, I enjoy the literature. I enjoy the game, and I don't think it's mutually exclusive to the person who's attempting to enjoy that. I don't think it's mutually exclusive for people of one religious background or another. So I think it is open for everyone.
Yeah, I mean, I think that literature in general, and to me, I approach religious texts as literature and as ancient stories. And to me, they can give some interesting insight into myself and what's happening in my life currently, just as much as playing a game in a horror realm or reading science fiction. Or, you know, to me, they all provide metaphors that I find useful. And so, I, in that way, there's certainly no conflict at all.
Yep.
Everything has something to offer.
I agree. So, thank you, Mr. Tyler. I thought it was very well said, yeah. and I am glad that you published that and shared that with us.
Yeah.
Same here. I was just going to say, it may be worth noting that Sandy Peterson is a Mormon and open about it, and also sees no conflict between, you know, all of his various genre loves. He loves horror movies. He loves, you know, all kinds of strange pop culture stuff. And he really loves the Cthulhu mythos. And he's talked about it before. So,
and it's... probably really confuses some of the other people at his congregation.
Well, it probably might, or he That's... might have just found like-minded folks who, yeah, you know, they all, yeah.
I like to imagine some very odd looks once in a while.
Right.
Well, especially when he gets his kids to sell pet rocks.
Yeah.
In a Kickstarter.
Yeah, yes. Yes. Gotta wonder. To summon undersea monsters for a love connection.
Yeah.
Nice. So.
That actually happened.
Settle down now, class. It's time for your next lesson.
All right. So, this came about from somebody, some feedback that was received back at Gen Con 2014. And so, yeah, it was Ian, the guy we played a game with back at GenderCon 2014, asked, any thoughts on game ideas based around From Beyond and other technology-based Cthulhu adventures would be very welcome. So, yeah, we're going to start at the Resonator and kind of go from there.
Yes.
Yay!
Ripples, follow the ripple effects. John's excited. Nice. Sample, resample, put in a little echo there. You've got your sound effect. You should talk to Sirenscape. Maybe you could do a little...
There you go. There you go.
Yeah, so... And one thing that we discovered while kind of prepping for this episode was that there aren't any specific statted out notes for the Tellingast Resonator that we could find, like, as an official thing. I think there were, like, individual scenarios that author had their own take on it, but there's no core book notes on the Tellingast Resonator.
And that utterly surprised me, because I even checked Pulp Cthulhu to see if in the Weird Science section, if they had the Resonator listed there as an example, right? I guess I would have... I don't remember when we covered this before, covered Weird Science and Pulp before. I just forgot, you know, because there are a few examples in here, but they're like little gadgets that the PCs could build or something like that.
Yeah, they're player-based.
They're player-based gadgets. Instead of, you know, something that the keeper could use as something that an adversary would have. And so you would almost think that the resonator and the cool air machine, you know, that they would have been statted out, you know, for as possible devices that could be encountered. But yeah, they're not in here. So very interesting.
Yeah, it is interesting.
That just leaves it open.
True.
Yeah, well, that's what I love about it, actually, is it's so wide open, and you can see in the various treatments that people have used, it's so open to interpretation, completely different directions, because the story is pretty short. It's not a lot of detail, just as they're often, as you often have with Lovecraft, not much detail, undescribable things. So you can go in whatever direction you want. It's awesome.
So, Chad, give us a high level review. What does the Tillinghast resonator do?
Well, describing exactly what it does it's not super clear how this does this, but and that's up for speculation, right? But it seems to tear down walls or membrane between two worlds, or alternatively, it just shows you the world that's already existing on top of the one we have, almost like exposing dark matter in a visceral way. And in the story, one of the properties of the things that it reveals is that you have to be very, very quiet, or those things will notice you. That's what you don't want. So the resonator goes on. You start to see monstrosities, indescribable shapes, both alive and otherwise, that start to move through and around you. But if you start to really look at them, and Tillinghast himself trains himself how not to gain their attention, but if you do start to, they will see you and they will devour you.
Yeah.
Which is what happened to his servants. Yeah.
Really big multi-dimensional piranha that you don't want them to get your scent.
Yes. Or they're described as jellyfish in some ways, but the thing is there's lots of different types of them.
Yeah.
And so that's one of the things I think that we all love about it, is you can propose almost any creature that is in this dimension that becomes unveiled.
It's interesting, you know, the concept of if you don't stare at it, if you're not challenging it, it'll you know, most likely leave you alone. Kind of reminds me of like the silverback gorillas, right? If you're in their habitat and you are submissive and don't challenge, you know, the alpha male, then you're usually you're not accepted into the pack, but you're not attacked, right? And so you can be there for observation purposes. And so I think that's interesting to kind of see something like that here. I mean, I doubt that Lovecraft was trying to mimic, you know, the behavior of the silverback, but you know, it's something that came to my mind that we could kind of compare to the way that these entities from beyond, you know, would react to folks in our frequency of a dimension, right?
Yeah, you gotta wonder what they're doing. Why is it that they would be malignant against this dimension? Why do they need devour?
I don't know. I mean, at least for me, it doesn't seem that big of a mystery, because I almost and maybe this is because of the seafaring kind of descriptions, you know, so the fish and jellyfish, you know, kind of descriptions for these creatures. But it almost feels like to me like the device, at least in the story, was displaying a dimension where it's more like what I would think of as predatory waters in the ocean, right? And so, you know, we're just simply among these creatures in their habitat. And now, because the resonator is starting to tear down and blend the realities together, we find ourselves in their natural, you know, part of the ocean, you know, air quotes ocean, from their dimension, and they're just surviving on, you know, finding prey that's weaker than them and eating it, you know.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's fair. I was thinking maybe that they could be imbued with, do you remember the Stephen King story Langoliers, or the movie? I think it was a TV movie.
Yeah.
Or no, yeah.
Yeah, it was TV. It was a TV miniseries or something, right?
Yeah,
miniseries. It was like two or three episodes or something like that. Each one's like 2 hours. Yeah. It was not that great, but interesting.
Filmed at my hometown airport in Bangor. It was like a big thing in college with a bunch of people getting jobs at the film set. But the concept there is that the Langoliers are these Pac-Man-like darkness monsters full of teeth that eat up the remnants of time so basically it's like our reality is a bunch of facades that are put up so that people can just operate, mm-hmm. and the universe only generates what you need. So then they strike the set when you're done. when you pass through that moment of time, then the Langoliers come and take away all of that set dressing. But you're not supposed to slip out of time, but if you slip out of time and start to see them, then they have to destroy you. It's almost like the elves at Christmas, or like fairies operating in the woods. Like, you're not supposed to see them making the shoes at night, right? So right,
yeah, that's
so maybe
that's
they do
a
have
whole
an intent,
new horror
right?
level to Shelf on the Elf, or the Elf on the Shelf, you know.
Yeah,
you're not supposed to see
what's
it. Now I have to kill the child.
The shoemaker's story,
right?
What is the shoemaker's story? And like, what if those were actually, you know, jellyfish creatures? They call them elves, mm-hmm. but you know, the thing that you've gotten favor from is actually this horrible monster, and if you sneak in and see them, you are done.
Yeah, I kind of like that.
Yeah, that's very cool.
I can imagine evolution-wise, extra dimensionally evolution-wise, that would be, they have to remain hidden or their world is threatened, or you know, like they're here all the mm-hmm. time, but they can't be seen because of whatever the work is that they're doing. Say biologically, or the structure, like eating time or whatever it is that they do.
Yeah.
Kind of like the Hounds of Tyndalus too,
their
right?
ecosystem.
Right. So I was thinking right. about this with the Tillinghast resonator. For me, I was kind of thinking of it like a radio frequencies. Okay. So, you know, you've got your AM and FM modulations, and you've got, you know, the different layers of frequencies that you could, you know, dial it to. And so, and while it's not, you know, explicitly described this way in the original story, you know, again, always open for interpretation, you know, so what happens if you're kind of start changing the frequency from what Tillinghast has? So now instead of a dimension where, you know, it's basically, you know, kind of like this ocean of creatures that are, swimming through all of our stuff, you know, maybe you're looking at another dimension in Earth's past or something like that. And so now through this device, the Hounds of Tyndalos are able to sense you. And what if it, you know, one of the interesting things about the Hounds is that they have to travel through time to reach you. And usually it's a pretty slow process, right? What if using the resonator turns that to almost a zero, you know, a zero effect? Like you've broken down the barriers for them, and so now the Hounds, they can just leap across, right? And get you immediately.
Mm.
Yeah.
It's a dog whistle.
It's a dog whistle.
Yeah.
Yes.
Come here, puppy. You want a milk bone?
That's the name of the scenario, dog whistle.
Yeah, I like that. Yeah, I like the idea that in a scenario, I could see something like it taking place after somebody like finds maybe notes of Tillinghast's original, you know, papers and tries to build something based on his original scribblings, which of course would have different settings to it and different responses.
Right.
But might tap into similar things.
Right, right. Yeah. So PCs have access to, you know, the investigators have access to some paperwork, and through study are able to find areas of improvement. And so they build something that takes the original concept but should do it better, right? But better comes with a cost.
Better comes with a very wide open definition.
Yes. Better for who?
Yeah.
Yeah. I think that might actually be something close to the concept in the scenario. I'm dancing around naming it, but it's in, is it Nameless Horrors? It's in Nameless Horrors. I'm not going to name the scenario. I'm trying to figure out how to not spoil it. But anyway, that there is a treatment of the Tillinghast resonator and the science of it there that's really, really different. It totally speculates stuff that, you know, we've never seen before. There's a kind of possession model, I will say, involved. That's really, really cool. But that thing about the notes that you talk about improving on, I think that's actually kind
something
of part
in
of
there.
That. Yeah.
Okay. Well, that's interesting. And the scenario that you're not naming, again, I won't name it either, but I will say that there is an actual play of it out there. And and I'm listening to it now.
Well,
and so it's pretty entertaining.
Right now, as we speak?
Yeah. Oh, yeah, there's an act.
That's a little bit rude. It's a little rude. I don't know.
Oh.
Right now?
Jerk. When I'm at work, avoiding work, okay. I'm listening to the actual play.
Okay, as long as you're not avoiding us right now
never.
At this job.
Never. I would never do that to Dan. Just Dan.
That's fair. There are a couple of other approaches that I thought were really cool. One is check out Dean Englehart's, and I guess I don't know what to do about spoilers, but anyway, we're gonna have a link in the show notes. It's called A Different Light, and it's a really cool scenario. And one of the cool things is that it delineates the types of creatures that come from that dimension a little bit. So there are, for example...
taxonomy.
Yeah. I think he names three of them. Yeah, there's renders, there's dissolvers, there are jelly things.
I like it.
Yeah, and those are the three. But I just like that could be... spread out, you know, that could be expanded upon infinitely, because you're just like if somebody suddenly glimpsed our world, you know,
yeah.
We have squirrels, mm-hmm. which are, you know, infinitely different than snakes, which are, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
So,
you know, I think it would just be a lot of fun for the keeper just to describe whatever weird stuff comes up off the top of the head and just let the players train come up with names for it and let them try and wrap their head around what they might be looking at if you just give them very vague descriptions of things.
Yeah.
Absolutely love that technique. Yeah.
Yeah. Letting them fill in their own gaps.
And honestly, if you need inspiration, we've said this before, but look at, just Google weird creature discovered or, news is full of totally messed up biology. There's that thing in the sewer that it turned out to be a colony of worms. There's, you know, feeding frenzies on beaches that look like a single tentacled organism. There's all kinds of weird cryptids. You could just plug those into From Beyond, figure out what they are trying to do or what their job is.
Yeah.
You know, within that world and go with it.
Or even just make it seem as alien as possible on what they could possibly be doing. Mm-hmm. Don't make it make too much sense.
Yes.
Because if the players can figure out what its intentions are, it's not alien enough.
True.
Yeah. Yeah, totally. I like the... Yeah, I like... The Greys have that whole thing of, like, they're experimenting. They just sort of want to understand pain, right? Mm. Greys as aliens, which I think show up. I think that's how Delta Green uses Mego to some degree. But they... Right? But, just finding an intention that is almost... I have to go on this. I heard this story about AI. I can't even remember if I mentioned it on the show before, but an example that's used when talking about the dangers of AI is, what if a manufacturer comes up with an AI whose main purpose is to make paperclips as efficiently as possible? It's like one sentence, right? But the result could be that, I mean, humans are kind of in the way of making the most amount of paperclips the most efficiently, right? The resources you need to make paperclips could actually, you know, it doesn't stop. The entire Earth could be, you know, reconfigured to create the most amount of paperclips. So that's, so when you're talking about alien intentions, that pops to mind. Like, just thinking of, like, they're alphabetizing the humans, you know? Whatever that means, by their own alphabet, right? And, like, maybe their alphabet is pheromones. So, like, who the hell knows?
Yeah. Their Dewey Decimal System is really, really painful.
Yes.
Kind of like ours.
How creepy of a taxonomy of a creature if you just called it the librarians from beyond, right?
They tend to sort you.
Yes.
So, and Delta Green has a pretty cool approach too. There's the whole, well, Artifact Zero is a famous scenario that everyone should play. It's just one of those twisty, really cool ones, and that's in that world. But also, Delta Green has this experiment that was done to have to disappear a ship. Mm-hmm. And they were using resonator technology in order to do that.
Oh.
I mean, isn't that based on the reality of like the Manhattan Project or something like that? Weren't they trying to...
Philadelphia Experiment.
The Philadelphia Experiment. I knew it was a city.
Yeah.
And, you know, of course, there's a science fiction film on it. But I thought there was an actual thing where they're going to try and, you know, radar make a ship radar and sonar invisible or something like that.
I don't know enough about it to know what the actual reality is of that particular thing.
You mean of what actually happened?
Even a program. It sounds like something reasonable that there would be a program, but as far as
not the achievement of visible invisibility, but, you know, of light rays, but of sonar and radar to be masked and invisible to those devices.
Yeah.
Right.
And then they somehow accidentally created what, teleportation, I think, is what the movie had?
Yeah, in the movie, it teleported. It was time travel.
Yeah.
Went through time.
Yeah. Some poor bastard wound up like halfway through the deck plating.
Yep.
It's like, oh, that's uncomfortable. Oh, that's... Oh, telling the family about that one's going to be difficult.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. No, it would just be lost at sea, nobody found. Sorry.
Yeah.
Here's your flag.
Yeah. Mm. He fell off. It's a big boat. He fell over.
That actually dovetails into something that I had been thinking about actually for ages, which is that there is an apocryphal story that ends up in sensation and perception psychology textbooks that is, so it's like poorly sourced, but it does actually end up in literature, that there were experiments in World War II
The way the visual system works is that vitamin A, that the vitamin, there is a molecule in there that respond is photoreactive, and that provides sort of the very beginnings of our visual system. There is actually a coating of these molecules on the back of our eye, right? Mm-hmm. But there are different kinds of vitamin A. So there was an experiment, if we are to believe these psychology textbooks, where what they wanted to do is replace that molecule with a just slightly different modified kind of vitamin A that would react to lower levels of lower frequencies of light, infrared and so on.
Okay.
The actual reason was to be able to detect infrared signals from ship to ship without the enemy being able to see. So you would basically take a pill and then you would be able to see frequencies that other people can't see.
And then it was just really just the ship to ship communication with the light that like blinks on and off.
Right. So it wasn't meant to be, you know, some kind of night vision goggles type of situation where you could see the enemy. Although, you know, maybe eventually. The original experiment, supposedly, was to be able to just be able to detect a blip of light, of infrared light from one ship to another. Oh. And then that was scrapped because of physical night vision technology actually was eventually used to be able to do communications in that way with other visual receptors, other, you know, like tech, mm-hmm. outside tech. You didn't have to take a pill.
Yeah.
But that is, we were talking before the show about different ways to get the same Tillinghast result. And that's one thing that I have always thought would be cool is what if there was a pill that would then allow you to see frequencies that, you know, that you shouldn't be
that
able to see.
Human is
beings
cool.
And just don't tap. Oh, I like that a lot. That's
and then when you make a, as soon as you make a pill, it enters the black market, right?
Yeah.
as soon as it's in pill form, it's you can't contain it. So that's
that's
possibly
a
something for over
idea.
The edge.
I love that.
Yeah, that would be very, very cool. I could see that maybe early development of that in a pulp game. And then, you know, make good use of it in something like, you know, a Octoon Cthulhu scenario.
Yep.
Yeah, they cooked this thing up. Here, take this.
I was originally thinking.
That's
totally,
cool.
Totally. I was thinking of it as a Vietnam idea, because if they were made in World War II, then they would have been possibly stored away. Mm-hmm. And then there were problems, extreme problems in Vietnam with tunnels.
Yeah.
Yep.
And so, you know, the need to be able to see in dark was really high. And so maybe out of desperation, these things would have been brought out. And if you can see what you shouldn't see, and then it sees you, that would make for a pretty horrific story.
Yeah. Yeah, I like that. You know, you hear screaming down in the tunnels, but it's not because they found the enemy. Something right. else found them.
Yep.
Well, yeah. And then you find remains that are... can't be explained with napalm or, you know, phosphorus grenades, I mean, or, you know, other tech that existed.
That's, yeah, I like that. Or the tunnel rats who are going in never come out and their bodies are just never found.
Mm-hmm.
Well, that happened anyway. So you've got, I mean, that is one of those situations where the reality is so horrible already that you know, it's almost tough to make it worse.
Yeah.
Yeah, I was having a spin on the Tillinghast resonator, I was thinking, you know, so in Lovecraft's story, the resonator, as we understand it, it stimulates the pineal gland of the brain, and so now the recipient is able to sense, primarily visual, but maybe some auditory senses of these other dimensions that you're dialing in, right? So then I was wondering, well, that's interesting. What if you did another device that was kind of, you know, built on similar principles, but it was designed to, stimulate a different portion of the brain. So now instead of the pineal gland, maybe it's the hippocampus or something, right? And, those who are, you know, within the area of effect of the device, they can now start hearing thoughts. You know, they've got telepathy. And now they're, as these other dimensions are, you know, because it's still breaking down barriers between other dimensions, or maybe dimensions through time, right? So now you're able to hear the thoughts of others or things that, you know, the memory of things that were in a certain area where this device is being activated. I don't know. Something to go on there. And there might be a kernel of something to build on in there.
Mm-hmm. Well, I definitely love the idea of the different senses. I mean, it's already in the story, right? It touches on not just sight, that you're seeing these things, but that you're hearing things, and that there's other senses are being activated. And I think that's a really fun way to play with this concept.
Yeah, absolutely.
So what other part of the brain would be cool to hone in on in the frequency?
Mm-hmm.
Like a language area?
Yeah.
Yeah. Basically, I could see where if you simply did some research on, you know, the latest information on what pieces of the brain do what, as far as we're aware, and just find something that does something interesting, and then just crank that up to the highest possible degree of weirdness.
Yes. Well, I mean, actually, the specific locations of things in brain in neuroscience is like less and less. It's not like they're all brains are the same necessarily, but there are like places where things tend to be, and there's a face recognition area.
Mm.
So it'd be pretty wild to jack that up to 11 or 111 and see what happens, because if the faces change, what would overactivate? I guess it would just make people, you know, I mean, this actually is sadly does happen in mental illness. When you don't recognize the people that you know, that is a horrific experience, right?
Yeah. Yeah, that's an actual condition where somebody just, they cannot recognize faces at all. But I could see where, say, that particular part of the brain has been, you know, tweaked and hijacked, and you can identify somebody's ancestor.
Oh, there you go. Yeah, yeah.
Like
ancestral memory that only you can see.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. You can, like, almost look back through their DNA and their family lineage. And if you run across somebody from Innsmouth, roll sand.
Right.
Oh yeah. Oh, that's a good one. That's a good one. The poison tree that is being worked on, I think, still, that campaign, has something to do with that lineage.
Oh.
I think Scott talked about it in the podcast, the live podcast that we did together, where something about genetic, you know, it's such a theme in Lovecraft to go back into your family tree and find something horrible.
Yeah.
And they are looking into how to do that in a campaign. But that would be, if you were doing a generation spanning campaign, as seemingly weak as that power is to be able to see somebody's family tree, that would be a very interesting way to, it's like a cantrip, you know, that has like amazing effects in certain situations where you need to know.
And horrible if you can't turn the thing off.
Right.
That's right. Right.
Yeah. I was also thinking that, you know, this this type of device has such a large area of effect, and it's, you know, globally affecting everything within that space. What if it is also changing the biology and the makeup of inanimate objects so that they become native? They become creatures and objects that are now native for the other dimension, right? So so now your investigators maybe don't notice it at first, but they go to open a door and their hand kind of passes through the knob. And now they're like, what happened there? And it's not because the knob is becoming immaterial. It's because they are becoming immaterial, right? And so, sanity effects for that. And then, you know, maybe the building is, you know, the where this is being done is starting to resonate into a different frequency, a different dimension, and so now it's, you know, how to the adventure becomes how to turn that off and get home if possible, right?
Please. My thought when you first started mentioning that was like I was picturing something like the various creatures described in From Beyond that were floating around, is that they were captured and started to meld with the physical objects from this plane. And so it actually, like, literally brought things to life.
Oh, there you go. Angry.
Oh, God, yeah.
Animated chairs and lab equipment.
Your
and,
shoes.
Yeah. Shoes. John was saying about the becoming non-corporeal is really horrible, like to have a ghost story in which the investigators are slowly becoming the ghosts is pretty great, and you'd have to be super creative because you're stripping some agency.
Yeah.
But imagine it gets to the point where you can't interact with the world you're investigating. You actually can observe, but you the only, you know, what would you do? Mm-hmm. What is the way you could bring agency back? I guess you could, you know, whisper to people and suggest things. I don't know how that would work, but it's
yeah, I'm thinking power rolls, magic point spends to focus. Mm-hmm.
Oh, right. So you can have a temporary like, okay, well, roll to turn the knob.
Yeah,
kind of cool.
I know of a treatment of the Telengast that uses luck spending, that it is a luck sapper. So that's another resource that you could draw from.
Yeah. You kind of have to keep spending it to stay invisible to the creatures.
Yes.
And eventually that's going to run out.
Oh, yes.
So, yeah, I like that.
Have you guys ever seen a movie that totally freaked me out when I was a kid? Called The Man with the X-Ray Eyes.
Oh, yes.
I've heard of it, but I don't think I've seen it.
It was on Creature Double Feature on Channel 56 in Boston. Shout out to Tim, who knows what I'm talking about. It's a Roger Corman movie from the 60s. And it's kind of amazing and kind of slapdash. But there's basically this guy is doing experiments on himself, and I forget what he's trying to solve, but it's real science. He wants to increase the range of human vision. He might be trying to work on blindness, but he develops these eye drops, and he's too impatient, doesn't want to use animals to experiment on, so he, of course, puts them in his own eyes. Mm-hmm. And over time, so then he gets this X-ray vision. And it increases, and he keeps putting more and more drops in, and so at first he can see like nude, you know, he can see clothes come off of women, and then he can start to see people's insides like X-rays, and so and he at some point is able to identify as a tumor or something that's wrong with someone. But it goes further and further and further, and then it gets just freaking psychedelic because he's seeing through everything to the ends of the universe. So there's a, it's almost like a From Beyond.
Yeah.
Possibly borrowed from it.
Yeah, it has been forever since I've seen that. When I was in Germany, when I was serving in the army, we had a like a really small DVD library, not DVD, a VHS tape library, right? And you know, people just go to this common library and just grab a VHS that you wanted to watch, take it back up to your room, you could watch some, you know, videos or whatever. And I remember watching a couple of times because we had Man with the X-Ray Eyes in that library. So every now and then you're like, it's kind of crappy. I'll watch it anyways. And so you grab the X-Ray Eyes guy and pop it in the DVD or the VHS player.
I love that. It's actually, it goes back to Mr. Tyler's theme because there's a whole religious underpinning. And I think that actually is the theme of From Beyond is this, you know, you careful what you ask for. It's like sort of monkey's paw of science.
Oh,
like,
yeah.
There are things you don't want to see, right? Mm. But he says, the doctor says to this guy who's doing the experiment, only the gods can see everything. And then he responds, my dear doctor, I'm closing in on the gods.
Nice.
There's this whole scene in a church at the end. Do you remember that, John? It's a whole monologue. It's really, his eyes become like...
Yeah, I was going to say like black orbs.
Exactly. And he can't stand it anymore because he can see through, you know, through the psychedelic spheres.
Yeah, I can see it through my own eyelids. This sucks.
Exactly. That was, yeah. And he started wearing like... sunglasses and it wrapped his head and
YouTube is your friend.
Yes.
It is. The whole thing is.
Yeah.
We can post that, right? I mean.
Yeah, I already put it in the notes.
Oh, you did?
At the end. Cool. Yeah, that's a cool idea. I like that with. Because that's what From Beyond basically is taking something that is neatly already there in people. And just cranking it up to an excessive amount.
Yep.
Yeah.
And then, of course, the feature film, which, you know, had it physically manifest in the most bizarre and disgusting ways possible. Which,
yes.
You know, was entirely appropriate. Pineal gland sticking out of your forehead.
Right.
That was awesome. It's ridiculous.
Yeah.
That also... Oh, there's just the psychosexual overtones that Lovecraft would never put in there, too.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I think that's partly why I love the Stuart Gordon translations so much, is because there were so many things that Lovecraft really would not have wanted anything to do with his story.
Yeah, totally.
There are women? It's actually a pretty cool film. I've seen it moderately recently in the last couple months, and I'm not sure if I'd actually seen it previously or not.
I know I had seen it previously, and I did buy it a few months ago, so it's down in my library downstairs.
Cool.
Yeah, it's fun.
Yeah, I know there's like a, I think Shout Factory actually put out like a really nice deluxe version of it.
Oh, cool.
So, Shout Factory is wonderful for that kind of thing.
Hmm. I don't know them. What is that even?
It's a company that they create. Well, they actually don't create, but they're a production company that takes. They find movies that haven't had high end releases, and they'll like take From Beyond and put out like a remastered Blu-ray with tons of extras.
Yeah, I think Brian Quartermanch. Like yeah, I think Brian Quartermanch, or is it Brian Sammons? I think it's Brian Sammons gets a lot of videos and reviews them from them, I think.
Mm-hmm.
Oh.
Yep, they've got, yeah. It, Shout Factory actually now currently owns the rights to Mystery Science Theater 3000.
Ah.
Oh, really?
And so they're the ones behind the... the resurgence and return of MST3K is that they bought the rights and they partnered with Joel. And so they're the ones behind the whole return because they love this old stuff. And so, yeah, I highly recommend go out to the Shout Factory website and just dig through their catalog. It's amazing what these guys have put out. And there's a ton of older Lovecraftian type of films that they've given really nice high-end treatments to.
So getting back to the actual Tillinghast resonator.
Yes.
You know, I'm looking, as we're talking, I'm looking at the Weird Science chapter of Pulp Cthulhu. And it's interesting that, you know, the devices in here, unlike a monster stat block or something like that, or a weapon stat block, these Weird Science devices don't have a formulaic stat block
mm-hmm.
that they follow. So it's very free form, and it looks like it. You could just simply populate whatever information you want to put into a device. And so kind of thinking about it in that way, that we're not really going to be beholden to a particular stat block, what would you guys, if you were to write up and try to codify the Tillinghast resonator, what are some elements that you would write for the Keeper so that they could try and run this in a fashion that might make some assembly of a sense.
Well, so one thing I was thinking about that I would definitely want, I like the open-endedness of it. So I think I would want to build on what you were talking about, John, where it's not just sight. And also, it's true that we have more than five senses. Mm-hmm. Scientifically accepted, we usually lump them into touch and other senses that we have, but
yeah.
Things like pain is actually a different sense than touch.
Yeah. And balance.
Sure.
Time. There's a sense, right? And so I think I would provide a little catalog of jumping off points to say, don't let yourself be limited to sight. All of these things are also, now that's pretty abstract. I would have to think about little paragraphs for guidance, because what would you do to say, detect pain that doesn't exist in our world? I mean, that's a pretty, you know, or itching is another kind of sense.
Yeah.
Some of these might be hard, but interesting.
Right.
One of the senses.
No, I like that. I like that idea. So if you were to try and write something up for the resonator, so you might start with a few tables that say, here are some of the different physical senses that could be augmented or adjusted in some mm-hmm. way. What about, I'm trying to think about if I was going to try and run and have a device and the investigators wanted to interface with that device, what would I, as a game master, as a keeper, what would I do to try and run that? And I feel like I would require maybe a intelligence test to use it, right? And so, you know, there's gonna be a response of some kind. And so I might have a table that I've put together that says, here are some possible results for a failed intelligence test, or here's for a fumbled one, right? Here's for a failed, and then, you know, success, hard success, extreme success, and then, you know, an ought one, right? And so I might try and build a table that's going to have these different types of effects. And then, depending upon the success band that they roll within, I can look and see what kind of results are in there. And there could even still be a variety of effects that are in there. So maybe it'll say, you know, roll once on the senses table, right? So now this particular frequency that they've attuned the resonator to, it's going to be impacting primarily. It'll be impacting, I liked sense of balance. I thought that was kind of cool to hear that, right? So sense of balance. So now anyone within the area of effect may be suffering from vertigo, okay? And because of the level of success that they had with the intelligence test, the more successful they are, maybe there's better or more positive outcomes that are possible, and then fewer, maybe fewer creatures, or hostile creatures, while not impossible, but fewer are available at these certain frequencies, right? And then, anytime the player, does this intelligence test roll and whatever the result they come with, now you can work with the players and say, okay, give me a number, give me a 3-digit number and name this frequency, right? And so now the players can say, okay, this is going to be frequency, 217. And so now they'll be able to, once they've had one success like this, or even if it was a failure, they're going to still name it, but now they can, mm-hmm. they can redial the device to 217 and it'll always be this, right? But the more that they try and explore this device and the more frequency numbers that they want to try and name and figure out a variety of different dimensions, the more attention that they could get from Hounds of Tyndalos, or the more attention that they could get from these terrors from beyond that live in these different dimensions, right? So it becomes a Pandora's box of just bad choices, right? How deep do you want to go in here?
That's
a good way. That's another myth that to tie to this too. That Pandora's box is basically from the ancient version of the From Beyond story. Yeah.
That's a great call. I like that. That would be a great way to try and have a resonating device in like a gaslight version of Cthulhu. Make it real steampunk,
Sure. Yeah. And something with like potential sand rolls and stuff, you could have a result be that somebody just gets really, really into that exploration and becomes almost addicted to the machine. And with what new experiences, what new sensations, then it also becomes kind of the lament configuration.
What's the lament?
The Hellraiser puzzle box.
Oh, I see
what you're saying. Yeah, yeah.
So yes. That's all about sensation. It's about the whole exploration of the depths of pleasure and pain and where they meet and overlap and all that.
What wonders we will show you.
Yeah.
Yeah. And so that would be an interesting side effect, is that this big old thing basically can do similar types of things. It wouldn't necessarily summon Cenobites, but there could be just weird responses. It could be changes to the people themselves doing it. Sand rolls could have all sorts of fun results.
Yeah, and I think, I forget what the mechanic is, and you don't necessarily need one, but use of these triggers a sand roll, and then you just say, from now on, you're going to have a hard time resisting going back and trying it again.
Yeah.
Right. And
make a hard pow roll to not mess with it.
Right. Or you can write, one of the things I like that you can do as a keeper is just describe that the thing happened and the player doesn't know that they did it. that they just kind of, I couldn't help myself, but don't let them know that they did it until afterwards. The Pandora thing could actually be a whole campaign frame. Right. Instead, that's one of the things I have trouble with the resonator. As you were saying, the tables and describing what it does, like, why would an investigator turn it on other than kind of by accident, hoping it was going to solve a problem? Like,
the From Beyond guy, this is a Frankenstein story. You know, it's a lie. You know, we do these things not because they're easy, but because they're hard. Yeah. He's just pure science. Like, let's see the reality. Sure.
Yeah, well, you know, and don't look back. The idea and needs to follow it through.
Yeah, and so, you know, the resonator is a key opening doors. And so what if someone beloved to the investigators has gone through one of these doors? And so now you have to use this resonator to continually open doors until you can find the right one that has your friend, and then get into that dimension, and it's a rescue mission, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. There is that. Yeah.
Mythos version of Sliders.
Yep.
That would have been awesome if every time they jumped in dimensions, they had to roll sand.
Right.
I was thinking that.
Yes. Chad, in the back, senses, you have your hand up. No. Go ahead.
Mr. Carter. One of the senses is, I forget what it's called, something by Znosia. Brasosmosia. No? Wait.
This is what a stroke sounds like.
Exactly. Someone call 911 for Chad.
Proprioception is what it's called. It is the sense that you know where your limbs are. So it's, you know, it's kind of gets lumped into touch as well. But basically, if you're in a sensory deprivation chamber, you are still able to know without seeing or feeling that your arm is bent, right?
Oh.
So that's one that I can actually come up with, a mythos corruption, where if you turn the resonator on that part of the brain, or, you know, or corrupt that sense, then you would see limbs that you didn't see before on you, you know, that you would see that there are, let's say, tentacles, for lack of a better Lovecraftian appendage, mm-hmm. or tentacles on other people, or limbs on other people. Well, that's sight. So it really would be yourself.
Yeah, your limbs are becoming tentacles.
Right.
Your limbs are bending in areas that have never bent before. Oh, my shin isn't supposed to mm-hmm. do that.
Or they can
extra knuckle
feel what appendages may be there in other realities and other dimensions.
Well, that's kind of what I was. Yeah, exactly. So that's interesting. Just that discovery alone means that you have a doppelganger who's kind of following along in your life path.
Yeah, exactly. It could be like you're feeling an alternate reality of yourself that evolution went different, and you've got a very different biology.
Nice.
Yeah.
The two versions of you, like, swap their sensations.
Yeah.
Something like that.
Yeah. And the two entities are moving together in parallel, mm-hmm. but they have completely different intentions.
Yeah.
And I think there's a lot that can be done with the Tillinghast resonator and other devices like it. And I think it's something fun to explore in your adventures, for sure.
For sure. Rife.
That sounded like a
wrap-up. Nice button.
It's a wrap-up.
That sounded like a big old button.
Let's put a bow on this damn thing. We want to hear from our listeners. We have a lot of different ways for you to reach out to us.
For a complete list, check out our show notes. That's where you'll find our email address, which is mup.feedback@gmail.com, as well as the phone number, SpeakPipe link, and our forums.
Send us your questions, feedback, and topic ideas, or join a discussion. Record a liner, tell us who you are, and give us a hearty go pods for our home team, the Fightin' Cephalopods.
Find all the links you need to keep in touch at mu-podcast.com/152.
Thank you for joining us for another episode. Class is dismissed.
The Call of Cthulhu role-playing game is property of Chaosium, Inc. The written works of H.P. Lovecraft are held in the United States public domain. All other works mentioned in this podcast are the property of their respective owners. original content of this show is copyright of the Miskatonic University Podcast under a Creative Commons Attribution Non-Commercial Share-Alike license.